Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry, lead researcher on a report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, who summarizes his investigation into how the super rich around the world have avoided paying taxes on an estimated $21 trillion of hidden wealth. Professor of Political Economy Garel Perovitz, who examines innovative, democratic, and sustainable alternatives to America's current failing economic system. And journalist and author Mark Hertzgard, who assesses the worsening weather and environmental conditions connected with climate change and a new group he's organizing called Climate Parents. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
"150 years after the abolition of slavery in the United States, the International Labor Organization estimates that 21 million people across the globe are victims of forced labor. China, a center of global manufacturing, recently debated and then dismissed a bill abolishing hundreds of forced labor re-education camps. President Obama signed an executive order last fall putting more teeth into a ban on federal hiring of contractors with ties to human traffickers. According to the magazine In These Times, in 2012, Chinese vocational students were forced to work in factories that make components for Hewlett-Packard and Apple during peak production periods. Students were reportedly told by teachers they had to work in the factories in order to graduate. After successive recent tragedies at Bangladeshi clothing factories, multinational corporations are feeling pressure to better police their overseas contractors for labor and human rights violations. The U.S. Department of Labor recently released its Toolkit for Responsible Businesses, which includes an 8-step guide for social and labor compliance and best practices. However, the agency, which also publishes a list of goods made with child labor, has no regulatory power to prevent corporations from importing these goods. Georgetown Law School graduate Karen Wu is putting off plans for having children until she finds a good job and is able to start paying off $164,000 in college debt. Wu, who is married, is among a growing group of young adults who are delaying having children or buying a home because of soaring student debt and poor job prospects. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the fertility rate of American women has fallen 50% since the baby boom years of the 1950s. Even as the U.S. economy slowly recovers, there is little evidence that the birth rate is rebounding. The lower birth rate may become the new normal, explains Chris Christopher, an economist with HIS Global Insight, as students take on record levels of debt to fund their education. The lower birth rate among young women in the U.S. follows a similar demographic trend in Europe. As the average birth rate falls below 2 children per family, added pressure is placed on social safety net programs to provide retirement benefits and health care for seniors. Over 200 immigrant workers met in Brooklyn in early spring to hear horror stories and watch a play illustrating the abuse of the city's car wash workers. Among the crowd, who loudly chanted, "Si se puede," or "Yes, we can," were powerful New York City politicians, including City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, a leading candidate for mayor. The year-long union drive among low-wage car wash workers is the product of a decade-long collaboration between Make the Road New York, a street-savvy community organization, and the Retail, Wholesale, and Distribution Workers Union. In recent months, 6 car washes have voted to join the union, and a car wash owner has signed a union contract. According to The Nation magazine, the groundwork for the community labor campaign emerged from a Make the Road organizing drive in 2004, dubbed Wake Up Bushwick. Over a 6-month campaign, activists talked with several thousand residents about working conditions in the neighborhood and solicited signatures pledging to boycott any store that did not respect its workers. The alliance also worked with New York State's Attorney General to file claims for unpaid wages, a tactic to increase the costs on anti-union employers. Make the Road's co-director Deborah Axt observed, "For many workers in the informal and non-union economy, we are trying to put as many pieces together as we can that offer protections of a union contract." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
During last year's presidential election, one of the central debates between Democrats and Republicans, between President Obama and GOP nominee Mitt Romney, was over how much should the nation's wealthiest citizens have to pay in federal taxes. On that issue, polls found most voters in favor of letting the Bush-era tax cuts lapse for the wealthy, while retaining tax cuts for families earning $250,000 and under annually. But a July 2012 report, undertaken by the Tax Justice Network, paints a disturbing picture of tax avoidance, finding that the super-rich in the U.S. and around the world are hiding at least $21 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding paying millions of dollars in taxes in their home countries. In the report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, the Tax Justice Network found that the wealth hidden in tax shelters is equivalent to the United States and Japanese economies combined. While the public is familiar with tax havens and banks located on far-off exotic islands, the report found that UBS, Credit Suisse, and Goldman Sachs are among the top private banks managing offshore accounts for the world's wealthiest people. The authors of the report, relying on data from the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations, central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, and other sources, concluded that the impact of unpaid taxes is staggering, where global financial inequality is much greater than originally estimated and growing. Your reporter spoke with the author of the report, James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company, who summarizes his investigation, tax cheating's effect on inequality, and how governments can reform banking regulations to capture billions in lost tax revenue.
Well, the headline number is $21 trillion of offshore private financial wealth. That's bonds and stocks, as well as bank deposits on alternate investments like hedge funds. It doesn't include so-called non-financial assets like real estate, art collections, yachts, and intellectual property. There's an important offshore market there as well. You know, most of the city of London is actually owned offshore at this point through offshore companies. What we're focusing on here is just financial wealth. Much of this is concentrated in the hands of about 10 million people at most around the planet. And the growth of the activity has been accounted for by a relative handful of major international banks, which have made it a business to help wealthiest people on the planet take their money out of their home countries, invest it abroad tax-free, and using a variety of schemes to defend it against taxation. The havens that we all hear about, the so-called treasure islands like the Caymans and Bermuda and the Bahamas and Panama, and Jersey. These are really to be thought of mainly as conduits in this system. The real destination havens for this capital and the place it actually ends up being invested are the major financial centers of the world, New York, London, Zurich and Geneva, Belgium is another one, Liechtenstein. These are places that people actually end up investing their capital. Nobody wants to have their funds sitting in, you know, Tortola or Bahamas for very long. So they use shell companies that are registered in places like Cayman Islands or Bahamas, and then the ultimate investments are made in these major countries.
James, briefly, please tell our listeners a little bit about how these offshore tax havens contribute to income inequality in the United States particularly.
Well, I think if it's possible for the wealthy to basically go back to the 1920s and roll back the clock to the days before really progressive income taxation, effectively legislating themselves a tax cut by taking funds offshore, you know, it's hard to reduce your tax rate below zero. You know, those practices are things that ordinary folks have a hard time keeping up with. So small business has a hard time, for example, taking advantage of the offshoring of intellectual property that companies like Google and Microsoft and Pfizer and other leading technology companies have used. They basically park their intellectual property in Bermuda or Ireland and then pay themselves royalties that are not taxed. And then they come back to the U.S. government and ask for a tax break when they repatriate all these profits they've offshored back to the United States. That's in the corporate world, and that's separate from the Price of Offshore Revisited. We're talking there about corporate, and this is about individuals. But there's a lot of ways in which this haven architecture has been abused and affects the distribution of wealth. One of them is on the corporate side. On the individual side, you know, it's basically an invitation to the more aggressive members of the wealthiest class to hide money offshore and to not report it in the home country and basically avoid any tax burden at all. So effectively, there's a lot of Romneys out there, and he's just one of many folks, probably not even the most aggressive in terms of this practice.
What's been the reaction to this report, and are there any viable solutions here in terms of reining in these tax shelters through international treaties or such? I wish it was simple, but I'm sure it's not. You'll probably tell me that.
We've seen a tremendous response from all over the globe. I mean, I've had inquiries from India and Russia, and journalists in Argentina. I mean, Chile, this is a global story. It's kind of unprecedented, the response we've had. And I've been studying this field since the 1980s. I mean, I wrote my first piece on this in 1986, and I have been waiting for, you know, any kind of interest on the part of policymakers. I think, you know, what to do about it, there are many things we can do to clamp down on the worst abuses, and we can have automatic information reporting, which the United States has with its friends in Canada and the UK, but it doesn't extend now to Mexico. The Mexican finance minister asked Tim Geithner to help share the same information on Mexican investors that he was giving to the Canadians, and they got no response. You know, that automatic information reporting on offshore earnings is an important step forward. I think regulating pirate banking and the kind of misbehavior of the big banks here is really something we ought to consider. And then it may be possible to get people to agree on a minimal tax while we're waiting for tougher enforcement. You know, that would just a 0.5% of what's parked in the banks now would generate enough to pay the entire foreign aid bill from the OECD. So at least we would get something from all the offshore tax evasion, the drug money, all the dirty money that's sitting in these offshore accounts while we're waiting for, you know, tighter enforcement.
That was James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company and lead author of the Tax Justice Network report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited. Find links to the report and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Economists and pundits tell us that the U.S. economy is slowly healing after the near collapse ushered in by the housing bubble bursting in 2007-2008. And while the unemployment rate was down a little in May to a four-year low of 7.5%, the real unemployment rate, which counts the underemployed and discouraged workers, is 13.8% of the workforce. The Great Recession exposed the unpleasant reality of many of the long-standing downward trends in the American economy, where the middle class is shrinking, income and wealth inequality are rising, and families are struggling to buy or keep their homes, pay health care bills, and afford college tuition. The ongoing partisan gridlock in Washington also reveals a political system where more often than not, those with the most money and power win elections and determine public policy, mostly benefiting the elite. The Occupy Wall Street movement, born in 2011, was an expression of this malaise, calling attention to a broken system urgently in need of repair. Into this bleak scene, where many citizens have come to believe that America's best days are behind us, Gar Alperovitz, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, tells us there are many reasons to be hopeful. In his new book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, Alperovitz examines innovative, democratic, and sustainable alternatives to America's current failing system. Your reporter spoke with Professor Alperovitz about new democratically owned enterprises that are thriving across the nation, such as worker-owned cooperatives, credit unions, public banks, and utilities.
The conditions of ever-deepening worry, pain, unemployment, inequality, ecological disaster, that's going on. Those are the deep trends. The fact is, however, they bring with them counter-trends. All great movements in history begin with the decay and the pain and the problems, but they also create consciousness and they create change and they begin to create reactions. And that's what I think we're seeing that the press doesn't either want to cover, and in many instances at the local level where the real action is, they no longer have staff able to cover what's going on. So we're seeing, and you know, the book What Then Must We Do is in the first instance, it's a report on a lot of research done here at the Democracy Collaborative on growing numbers of worker co-ops, of public land trusts, of municipalization, of state bank efforts, of things that are developing. I think that we are indeed in a systemic crisis, and not simply a political crisis, and that it's creating the potential, and I certainly would not use the word inevitable, but the potential for something much, much more powerful as the pain sinks in and people realize that there's got to be a different direction.
Professor Alpervitz, your book tells us there are many signs of hope, as you've been saying. People are open to new ideas and pursuing innovation in better and fairer ways to organize their economy.
People don't realize there are something like 11 million people already involved in one or another form of worker-owned company in the United States. And that partly that's older forms that have developed over the years, and partly it's a whole new wave of new co-ops developing. That then out of this pain level and out of a hunger for something new, the new things are beginning. Or take another one. There are 130 million Americans involved in cooperatives in general, consumer cooperatives as well as producer cooperatives. If you take the credit unions, if you take them all together, they're bigger than one or two of the big banks in New York. These things have existed in the past, and they're an old kind of rediscovery, but they're also a whole new wave that are building on this. And notice the important thing about the worker-owned companies or the co-ops or the credit union. Credit union is a one-person, one-vote bank. All of that is a democratic way to own wealth. That is, one-person, one-vote co-ops or one-person, one-vote worker-owned companies or credit unions, one person, one vote, as opposed to the highly concentrated ownership of corporations, where a mere 400 people have more wealth than the bottom 180 million. That's the kind of symbolic buildup we see in many parts of the economy just below the surface. Democratizing ownership at the neighborhood, the workplace, many things going on in cities and states we can talk about, plus some national crises that are pointing towards ever more interesting changes in healthcare and banking, big sectors. So there is, beneath the clouds, something is brewing that may have real power, and that's the way it usually is in when fundamental change is posed. It's not inevitable, certainly, but also it's not inevitable that the pain is going to go on for a long time with nobody reacting to it.
Well, a final question for you, Professor Alpervitz, and that is, in looking at the critical mass that I'm sure you and many listeners would like to see reached in terms of really producing alternatives to our current workplace and economic system overall. What kinds of relationships should the major social justice movements have with this developing new cooperative movement to give it a push to advocate for public policy changes that would provide technical support and financing to really push co-ops beyond where they currently are? As you said, it's kind of below the radar, but it's developing in an organic way. But what in your mind should be happening now to really push it to another level?
Well, and again, it's not only co-ops. There's a whole range of things. That there's public banking. There's a whole big changes going to public health systems as well, at the local and the national level. You know, we're going to see these banking crises that happen again and again, and there's a whole set of ideas being developed at that level as well in the banking system. And the way to think about this is like the decades before the New Deal, where the state and local level in the so-called laboratories of democracy, people were working out how to do the things that became national programs later when the moment was right in the New Deal. This is the prehistory, I think, of the next possible fundamental transformation, building up these changes in democratic ownership. So I think that there are policy issues that could develop: technical assistance, training, research, finance, all of those, public procurement, purchasing from co-ops and worker-owned companies rather than from big corporations. There's a whole list of things that people are developing, many of which, again, are described in the book, that point towards a program. But I think the hard work has got to be developing in your own area. What excites me about this is everywhere you look under the radar of the normal press, you will find the ingredients of a long-term program. And as the pain levels develop, I think people are beginning to get serious about democratizing things in a way that could build for the future.
That was Gar Alpervitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. For more information on the book and the future of worker and publicly owned enterprises, visit our Between the Lines website
at btlonline.org. The year 2012 is on track to be the hottest in recorded history, while high temperatures and drought conditions have been linked to destructive forest fires and other natural disasters that are exactly the kinds of occurrences that climate scientists have predicted will come with global warming. Yet the June Rio Plus 20 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, which commemorated the first Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil in 1992, was widely criticized as a failure for producing an international agreement which lacks enforceable commitments to confront and reverse climate change. Mark Hertzgard, author of Earth Odyssey, reports on the environment for The Nation magazine, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and other publications. His newest book is titled Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, which he wrote for his daughter's generation. Hertzgard says after his daughter Kiara was born 7 years ago, he became even more adamant about addressing climate change and holding to account the political and business leaders who ignore the Earth's and its people's plight. In his book, he notes that climate change has arrived almost a century ahead of predictions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Hertzgard about the worsening weather and environmental conditions connected with climate change and a new group he's organizing called Climate Parents.
We are living with climate change now. It is going to get worse simply because of the physical inertia of the climate system, the fact that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for decades after it's emitted. So we've got a big job ahead of us, there's no doubt. And meanwhile, we've got the President of the United States not saying a word about global warming, even though he knows perfectly well what the science tells him. We don't see any real leadership coming from the national level. So I think it really is going to, as always in history, it's really going to rely on people from the bottom organizing together and forcing their leaders to do what's right. And that's something that I'm getting started now with a group called Climate Parents. We want to try and organize and mobilize parents around the climate issue because it certainly endangers, climate change endangers, the thing that we all hold most dear in our lives, which is our kids.
Say more about Climate Parents.
Climate Parents is a new group that a number of us are just beginning now, and its agenda is simple. We think that parents are the single most underorganized constituency on climate change, which is quite bizarre when you think of what's at stake for our kids. And so what we want to do is to give voice and political impact to parents across the country and across the partisan political spectrum. We don't believe that climate change should be a partisan political issue because we think all parents want to have a safe and healthy future for their kids. But we also think that dealing with the climate issue now is part of your job description as a parent, just like providing your kid with proper food and clothing and shelter and health care and all those things. Climate change and dealing with it is now part of the job description of being a parent, because we now know that my daughter, Kiara, who's 7 years old, she and the rest of her generation are now fated to spend the rest of their lives coping with what will be the hottest and most volatile climate in the 10,000 years of human civilization. So you can think of today's young people as what I call Generation Hot, and we owe it to them, having put them in this predicament. We owe it to them as their parents, their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, anyone who cares about young people. We owe it to them to try and find the ways to let them cope with this problem successfully. And let's emphasize here, we know how to deal with climate change. We have the solutions. We know what to do technologically. It's all there, solar and wind power and geothermal and energy efficiency and all of the other solutions. I go into them in great depth in my book, Hot. That's not the problem. The problem is the lack of political will and the fact that our government is still under the control of very large business interests who profit from the current situation. know, the oil companies, the coal companies, natural gas. I mean, it is remarkable and bizarre that our tax dollars are now being spent in the billions to subsidize ExxonMobil, the single richest, most profitable corporation in human history. We are subsidizing them to wreck the climate for our kids.
Mark Hertzgard, so this is a group to apply political pressure on officials.
We do think that it does have to be political involvement. It's nice and it's important as a first step for a family to change their lifestyle choices and their consumption patterns so that you know, maybe you take mass transit more often than the car. Maybe you eat less meat, more vegetables, and, you know, as a whole, you know, take the bicycle and all of these sorts of, there's a lot of personal lifestyle changes that you can make, and those are useful. But they are much, much less than what is necessary to solve this problem. As long as we have an economic system and rules of the road economically that essentially allow carbon dioxide pollution to be emitted for free, nobody pays a price for that, certainly not the corporations or us, the consumers. It's not incorporated into the price. Indeed, as I said, we're subsidizing oil and coal and natural gas. As long as that's the case, we can't make much difference. We've got to change the main drivers of climate change, and those are the government policies and the business practices of today's world. We can do this. We know how to do this. It's a matter of changing the big political decisions, and that requires people to get involved in politics. I know for some people that's about as enticing a prospect as getting a root canal, but I just would remind you, especially if you're a parent or a grandparent, that, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't really feel like doing, but we do them because they will make a difference for our kids.
That was journalist and author Mark Hertzgard. Learn more about his group, Climate Parents, and the effects of climate change on weather and the environment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.